start out by giving you a warning and giving you the opportunity to leave while you still can. Okay, now, in my kind of role as a Buddhist monk, and I do a number of different kinds of things. You know, a lot of times when people come to Dhamma talks and to teachings and so on, you try to make people happy, right? It's all about happiness, this whole happiness movement. You want people to feel loved and accepted. So this is one thing we try to do. We want people to leave feeling just a bit better about things. Sometimes also, you don't just want to make people feel better, you want to make people do things. Right? You want to make people change, live better, make the world a better place. At least a little bit. And so we have this aspect to what we do as well. So this evening I'm not going to do those things. I do them a lot. If you want that stuff, you can come to one of my other talks and I'll do those things. But tonight, I want to fill you with dread. I want to make you feel despair. I want to make you feel that you don't know whether life is worth living. So like I said, it's free to leave before it gets too late. These are emotions and responses which are not talked about very much in Buddhism these days, but are central to the story of the Buddha himself. And we've all heard the story of how the Buddha came to the spiritual life when he came and went out and he saw the four signs, old age, sickness and death. And, well, the first three signs anyway, old age, sickness and death, and then was filled with despair. Had what today we would call an existential crisis. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. Everything that he thought had value suddenly had no value anymore. Everything he thought had meaning was empty. Didn't have meaning. And so it was only after going through that process that he was able to see some hope. See the possibility that there is a spiritual life and a spiritual response that can really make a difference. I've talked about and spoken about this, the question of climate change on a number of occasions, and it's something that I have wrestled with and I'm still groping towards. It's something which I think has been so deeply poisoned in our public sphere that it's difficult to talk about it honestly. Those who are in denial of the very idea of climate change have made it virtually impossible to have a sensible conversation about it. And we saw the extent to which this goes in Australia just a couple of weeks ago. Hopefully you saw the quite unbelievable interview where our Attorney General George Brandis said that his restriction on his move to repeal or reform 18C on the one's right to be a bigot, as he puts it, was actually largely prompted by climate change. I mean, this is quite astonishing, right? Everybody had this debate about freedom of speech and whether you can abuse people and so on, and no one had suspected that climate change had anything to do with it. But apparently for him, the fact that those of us who live in a world where reality matters and are not willing to keep on debating a non-issue with people who refuse to live in a world where reality matters, that this was a fundamental infringement of their right to be idiots, I guess. So we're moving towards an uncertain future. The future's uncertain all the time. We know that. Right? We know we're all going to die. We know we can't predict the future. But the kind of uncertainty, the depth of suffering, and the most important thing really is the loss of potential. The loss of potential for humanity is just unprecedented in our generation. And I do think that we are the pivotal generation. The people who live now and the choices that we make now will determine our survival in the future. So this is, of course, is one of the basic teachings of the Buddha. Anicca sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajjitva nirujhanti te sangu pasamo sukho. You recite it at every funeral. The words that were recited when the Buddha passed away. So everything in this world is impermanent. But what's interesting about this verse, and what's very challenging and very powerful about it, is the last line. Tesam rupa samo sukho. Their ending is bliss. What does that mean? Yeah, I mean, it's trivial enough to say, well, all things must pass. Everything's impermanent, everything changes. We know that. But their ceiling is bliss. What does that mean? Perhaps we could, I remember a joke I heard some time ago, a little while ago actually, two planets having a cup of tea. And one said, how's it going? The other said, well, I haven't been feeling all that well lately. And the other one says, oh, what is it? He said, I think I've got Homo sapiens. And the other one says, don't worry, it'll pass. So from the planet's point of view, the extinction of the human race might well be quite a nice thing. But I think we are sometimes a bit cavalier in this regard. Actually, human beings are glorious. Human beings are amazing. I mean, nature is wonderful. We are part of nature. And in many ways, we're the best part of nature. We are, as far as we know, the most conscious part of nature. Right? We are nature become conscious. Yeah? We are able to reflect back on nature, to reflect back on the world we live in, to reflect back on ourselves, to become aware of that, and to develop ourselves and to improve ourselves. So I'm not cynical about humanity. Joke aside, I think humanity is wonderful, and if we can support a big human population on the Earth is very generous, it's very bountiful. And if we can do that, I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that it gives a wonderful opportunity for us to become more conscious in whatever way that might be. I mean, for Buddhists, that means more people doing meditation, practicing the Dhamma, getting enlightened. That's the best thing that can happen in the universe. We can do that here. Right? Our generation, we can do that. Right? We can come along to the Buddhist library, right? And do our meditation, do our classes, and we have the luxury to be able to complain that the class isn't on the time that's the most convenient for us. Right? We can do that. But I don't know for how much longer we're going to be able to do it. And the Dhamma is something which requires a certain degree of stability and peace. I mean, pretty much every Buddhist country that I know of, maybe China might be an exception to this, but pretty much every Buddhist country has been through periods when the Dhamma was virtually gone. Wiped out, Sanghas disappeared, almost everything's gone. There's still kind of a memory, still maybe some monuments, I don't know, maybe some texts hidden away in some old building or something like that. And then it comes back. So this happens. So whether we see it in Buddhist terms, in terms of meditation, developing consciousness or not, the fact is that as humans, we do have this awareness, we do have this understanding, we've got this incredible potential to do these amazing things. And how much untapped potential is there? What do we do with those amazing things that we create? Each one of you has in your pocket enough computing, more computing power than it took to send Neil Armstrong to the moon. Yeah? Right? NASA used that for sending someone to the moon. You use it for checking Facebook. We have this incredible potential. What are we going to do with it? Okay, how bad are things going to get? I think that almost all the media reports that we get on climate change are massively watered down. And the reports we get from sort of conservative bodies like the IPCC You know, they accurately represent the science, but they represent a certain take on it. They represent a consensus take, what they can get everyone to agree to. And that's necessarily somewhat behind the sort of curve. There are many different ways of looking at this, and I just want to, for the next few slides, we're going to be looking at just some of the facts and figures. And most of the data that I'm getting for this next little bit is from one blog post, which is on a site, it's maybe a bit small to see it there, but it's on a site called thinkprogress.org, and it's a Science of Global Warming Impacts Guide. The author is Joe Rome, who's one of the best known writers and bloggers on climate change, and he did this fantastic survey, and what I'm presenting here is just a few extracts from that, and it's got a lot of details. They're all linked to the original studies and so on. That post was done in 2012, so it's a little bit out of date. Hopefully he'll update it, but I haven't seen an updated version, and I haven't seen a better one, better summary of it. These are some of the things that he mentions as a summary of what's going to be happening. Staggeringly high temperature rise, especially over land, perhaps 6 degrees. 5 or 6 degrees seems to be a fairly mainstream estimate for the temperature rise by the end of the century. These days, the IPCC report, the business as usual scenario, was looking to up to 4.5 degrees by 2090, and that's almost certainly conservative. Permanent dust bowl conditions over the US Southwest and many other regions around the globe that are heavily populated and or heavily farmed. Sea rise of perhaps a metre or more by 2010. Massive species loss on land and sea, perhaps 50% or more of all biodiversity. Right? Just stop and check that for a moment. 50%. And recent studies have estimated 50 to 70% of all biodiversity will be gone by the end of the century. Right? We are living right now through what is by far the most rapid and devastating collapse of biodiversity that our planet's ever seen. It makes the age of the collapse of the dinosaurs look like a picnic. Yeah. 50 to 70%, that's how many thousands or millions of species becoming extinct by the end of the century. And of course, we use the end of the century as just a convenient marker point because we have to say by some time. But it doesn't stop there. It keeps going. Yeah? The temperature keeps going up. The sea level keeps on rising. Then there are unexpected impacts. The unknown unknowns. A lot more extreme weather events. Food insecurity. We have to feed maybe 9 billion people in a world with an ever worsening climate, as well as a myriad of direct health impacts. I'll just go give a few examples of some of these, not all of them, and not too many examples. Here we're looking at a map showing some droughts and potential dust bowl conditions. The top map's from about in the 2060s, the bottom map's in the 2090s. So this is already, you know, beginning quite a way from where we are today. As you can see, the red and dark red areas are the basically drought conditions. The mid-red area around here, I'm going to go cursor. So the mid-red area here is more or less what the Dust Bowl was in America. You know, the famous Dust Bowl they had, what, in the 30s, was it? Yeah. So that's roughly around that kind of mid-orange colour here. And as you can see, the position in America, even by 2060, is far, far worse and is getting to these very extreme conditions. This image of Australia in the 2060s is already much drier than it is today, and then it keeps on getting worse. And you can see also extremely bad conditions prevailing throughout Africa and the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world. A few places, of course, it will get wetter, but as you can see, only very few. Okay. So again, just to think about what this means, right? I mean, the American Midwest, yeah? You drive through there today and there's cornfields, grain, everything as far as you can see. It's not going to be there. Yeah? Who's going to be able to grow food in those places? Who's going to be able to grow food in Australia, in the wheat belt, in different areas? It's an example of the unknowns. And this, I thought, was quite an interesting example. He gave didn't quite manage to get the photograph on there very well, but the black little creatures in there are the pine beetles in Canadian pine. And so this is just one example. And no doubt there will be thousands, perhaps millions of examples which are similar. Pine beetle infestations, the first major climate change crisis in Canada. Who would have thought, right? Nobody said, oh yeah, climate change, pine beetle infestation. Projected to kill 80% of the merchantable and susceptible lodgepole pine in parts of British Columbia within 10 years. Okay, so that's basically wiping out a major industry within 10 years. This impact will convert the forest from a small net carbon sink into a large net carbon source. Okay, so instead of bringing carbon out of the atmosphere, it'll release it too. And of course that's then has a whole range of other knock-on effects in terms of animal habitats and the livelihood of people in that area and so on and so forth. So one of the points which Joe Rong was making in this article is that when people consider the impacts of climate change, they usually consider it piecemeal. You know, you think about one thing, or maybe the sea level's rising or the temperature's going up or something. But we have to consider all of these things will be happening simultaneously. Is food prices. Right? So remember, we live in a world today where there are, I don't even know how many, 1 billion, 2 billion people in the world? We lose count, don't we? It's so easy. And you get into the billions who don't have enough to eat, who can't afford to eat right now. Yeah? And this is the projection of the real price change in the next 20 years. Okay, and the bottom is different kinds of food, processed foods, processed rice, livestock, wheat, other crops, paddy, rice, and maize. Yeah, so this is the projected price without taking into account the impacts of climate change, and this is the projected price with the impact of climate change. Okay, so you see that's just 20 years. That's not a huge amount of time. And again, that's a major difference. Remember that there's how many millions or billions that can't afford that much. Right? You and I aren't going to starve anytime soon, but a lot of people are going to starve. This is from Oxfam, this information. If you go to that site I showed before, it gives you all of the sources for these things. You can check for yourself. So this is another one. I've got the slides a bit out of order here, but this is another one. This is projections on sea level rise. So here are 1950, 2000, 2050, 2010. So you can see a slow sea level rise up to about now, not much change. And then getting much faster, the spectrum here is based on different scenarios, so different kind of possible, you know, depending on how we respond, right? So if we aggressively respond to limit climate change, we'll probably keep it down there, so that's about 60 to 80 centimetres by the end of the century. But in fact, at the moment, we're on the A1 S1 level, which is the highest projected level. And so we're more looking at 1.5 metres sea level rise by the end of the century. Okay. 1 metre sea level rise means that 17% of Bangladesh will be underwater. Okay. And that's the heavily populated part of Bangladesh. Yeah. 17%. Yeah. Where are those people going to go? Yeah. Bangkok will be underwater. The Mekong Delta will be underwater. In fact, our region will be one of the most directly impacted by sea level rise. And you have to remember, this is happening. All those tens of millions or hundreds of millions of displaced people will be going to areas who are then suffering from drought and war and water shortage and all of these kinds of things. And these are all happening again and again over on top of each other. And they're happening in parts of the world which are already politically and socially extremely disadvantaged and often very unstable. Yeah? Countries that are barely coping to provide basic facilities for people even now. So this is sometimes in the denialist sphere. People say these are just models and how can we rely on them and so on. Well, of course, actual climate scientists know that models aren't reality, and they work very hard to make their models fit reality as best as possible. But of course, you can't always do that, and it's especially difficult to extrapolate into the future when you have multiple uncertainties, right? And when you have things which are, as they are becoming, completely outside of the range of what has been known. Right? So models work well when you can extrapolate from the known to something that's fairly similar to the known. And we're moving forward into a world where it's becoming increasingly more difficult to do this. So this is a comparison of different models of Arctic September sea ice extent. Okay, so all of the grey and black lines are different models. The models are listed up here, a bit too small to read them, but they're just different models and different projections, right? So different scientists run different models with different sets of assumptions and procedures and so on, and they get different results. But as you can see, the different results by applying multiple different models are still roughly following the same pattern, that the Arctic sea level is going to collapse drastically by the end of the century. So this is down to zero in September by the end of the century. And as you can see, the red line is what the observed effects of the actual Arctic sea ice extent. And so you can see up till, that's around 2000 or so, it wasn't too far from where the models were. And then in the last few years, and I'm sure we've all seen this on the news, in the last few years the level of Arctic sea has, Arctic ice has dropped spectacularly, so that it's now much, much worse than any of the models. And there are this is not just this case, there are actually multiple instances of this kind of thing happening, where the projections have been shown to be, in fact, much less severe. Even if, for example, if you look closely at the IPCC report, it will tend to modify its projections in an upward direction. Right? So each report tends to say things are going to get worse. And that's based on, of course, more extensive data, more accurate modelling and so on. So this is just a few things. We haven't talked about the changing in the water temperature, the sea ocean temperature. Yeah? When the ocean temperature changes, all the fish change. And what the fish eats change. What the fish eat changes. They go somewhere else. Everything changes. The change in the deep sea temperature, which has recently been measured. And this is quite a dramatic problem, because it's something which is not easy to observe, but it's something which has a dramatic effect, right? The amount of heat going into the oceans is equivalent to, and I can't remember the number off the top of my head, I think it's like 100, is it 100 or 1,000 Hiroshima bombs every second? Something like that? That's the amount of heat energy that's being absorbed into our oceans. Okay. A lot of the projections on sea level rise, again, they're kind of based on what's known and what can be extrapolated, but there are a lot of abrupt events which can happen to change that quite suddenly. For example, the Greenland ice shelf. One of the reasons for originally choosing a 2-degree limit and saying we shouldn't go above 2 degrees was because it was felt that by limiting temperature rise to 2 degrees, we could prevent the Greenland ice shelf from collapsing. And it seems increasingly that that's actually not going to happen. There were some recent findings to show that a large area of Greenland, which had previously been assumed to be stable, is in fact collapsing, and that wasn't taken account of in any of the models. And similarly with the Antarctic ice shelf, recent studies have shown that a large part of it is in fact much more susceptible to collapse than we had previously thought. In addition to these, then we have the acidification of the oceans, we have the release of methane from the Arctic tundra, we have the recently shown fact that the fugitive emissions from gas fracking of methane is about double what the previous industry estimates had led us to believe. So the idea that gas is somehow a bridge fuel now falls in a heap. And so on and so forth. I could keep on depressing you for some time, but I will have mercy on you. At least a little bit. And remember, all of these things happening at the same time. Right? Not one thing we can deal with, and the tornadoes, and all of the other things that's happening, and the bushfires. How are we going to cope? Really? You might, you know, you might look at the headlines and think, well, you know, our politicians haven't got a clue. Well, you're right. I've been to Canberra a number of times as part of ARC, Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. We've spoken to the politicians, and yes, it's quite right, they don't have a clue. They're not acquainted with the basic facts. Some of them are, and obviously they're different. Some of them have more acquaintance than others. Tony Abbott said to us, 1 meter sea level rise, not a big deal, we can cope with that. That's what he said. One sitting member of parliament said to us a few weeks ago, CO2 isn't a pollutant. Yes, I know, yes. CO2, we don't have to worry about it. CO2 is not a pollutant. These are the things that are actually believed by the people who are running the country. Right? And who are making the decisions, who are sacking 1,600 workers from CSIRO and saying we have too many trees and dumping millions of tons of coal residue stuff on the Great Barrier Reef and opening all the coal mines and... Oh, and the worst thing that the current government has done, incidentally, is something which has not been reported very much in Australia, but is regarded internationally as outrageous and grossly immoral, is that we have reneged on our international obligations to pay for climate change abatement funds for the developing world. Okay? Every developing country accepts responsibility. It's our industries, our economies that have created the problem, and every international country has commitments to give money to a fund to help support third world countries, developing countries, to adjust to climate change. And Australia has said, no, we're not going to give anything. So, nature gave us this. We made this, so we can have this. In brief, this slide here, actually, this one, thanks to Venerable Jason, who put me onto this. This is the town of Bolga. Is that how you say it? Bolga? Bolga? Bolga, yeah. Which is inland from Newcastle. And one of the many massive coal mines being developed in Australia. You know, I just came back from India a couple of months ago, and we were on a bus tour with 50 people. All of them got sick from the air pollution in India. New Delhi's 50% worse than Beijing. Right? The air pollution in New Delhi is 50% worse than Beijing. The whole country is so polluted. And the people who suffer most are the women. Right? And they work all day in small enclosed places with fires burning coal and cow dung and so on, and no ventilation. And then I got back to Australia, and I found Australia's signing big international deals to sell massive millions of tons of brown coal to India to fuel their economic growth. And even the Indian companies are actually developing some of the mines in Australia. So we can have this. Right? This is just up in Newcastle, right? Just near Newcastle. Now, I don't know exactly where how the train of stuff goes, right? But these light bulbs, what are the? Do you guys have? Is it renewable electricity here? You don't use renewable electricity. No. 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 You feel
she is a diplomat.
Yeah? You could put some solar panels on the roof, yeah. So, you know, even a good organization like the Buddhist Library, right? Full of conscious, ethical, good people. These lights right now, this projector, this computer, it's all being powered by this. And when we were at Santi a few years ago, we switched over to green power, and it doesn't make any difference. I mean, we didn't even notice in terms of the cost of the electricity bill or anything like that. I mean, this is what, to me, it's so painful for it. I mean, it's so unnecessary, actually. All of this stuff. Why? I don't go to shopping centres often, but so occasionally you end up in a shopping centre and you look, God, why? Why do people want these things? Why do people want these huge houses? I don't understand. It's all so silly. So one of the things which I'm trying to convey or trying to hold in the room and in the space today is just the ability to face the facts, to bring them on board without apologizing, without making excuses, without immediately having to say, so what can we do about it? Right? I mean, this is what you have to do in activism, right? I was in animal liberation from 1985, right? I've been in the activist sphere for my whole adult life, right? And I know this is rule number one, right? You give people some bad news, you've got to give them, what do you do about it, right? Yeah? And I'm not going to do that, okay? Because I think it's trite. Yeah? I think in most cases, yeah, sure, there are things we can do. And of course you should be doing things, right? And we all should be doing more. I don't mean to say that. I don't mean to suggest we shouldn't do things. I don't mean to suggest that there's nothing that we can do. What I'm suggesting is that our compulsion to do something, right, stops us from fully taking the time to contemplate what kind of world we're going to be living in. What kind of uncertain future is facing us, facing our children, our children's children. Yeah. So I think we become too shallow in our responses because we're too quick to say, yes, we can do something. Yes, we still got time. Yes, we can. I really hope that we can, but I don't know. It seems likely to me that we're not going to make the changes we need to make. At the very least, we have to accept that there's some chance that we might not, okay? What do we do then? What do we do if in fact, nothing we do makes any difference? What do we do if we say, okay, we will change our lights and go on green power, and then another coal mine opens shipping 30 million tons of coal to China and India? What are we going to do then? So this, I think this kind of profound and existential response to things is something that we find frequently in the Buddha's teachings. I already mentioned the story of the Bodhisattva going from his home and seeing the old man, the sick man, the dead man. But there are plenty of other examples. This is a very interesting sutra, and I'm just going to give you some. I'm just going to read through a few passages from a couple of suttas that talk about these things in a couple of different ways, just to give you some ideas of how we find these things in the Buddhist texts. So this is from Majjhima Nikaya number 28, the Mahahatipadopama Sutta. Now there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. It carries away villages, towns, cities, and countries. This is summarized by, there comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean are not enough to even wet the joint of a finger. When even this external water element, as great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change. What of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a little while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So the Buddha was very conscious of the impermanence of the natural world. And this is something which is actually inherent in the Buddhist worldview, the Buddhist cosmology. not just Buddhist, but the Indian cosmologies generally. We don't see this world as being the one and only world. We don't see this universe as being the one and only universe. And we don't see it, we certainly don't see it as being permanent. We see the world as being part of a cycle, rising and passing away on that scale of eons, just like we see things rising and passing away in the here and now. And so you can imagine what it's like to have an ocean that is disturbed. The external water element carries away villages, towns, cities and countries. Well, we've seen that, haven't we? Yeah. We've seen that on the news. We've also seen it when the waters sink down and disappear. The very elements are rioting. There comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. It burns up villages, towns, cities, districts and countries. I'm resisting the impulse to crack a joke about our environment minister and Wikipedia and the bushfires we had in Australia in November, but anyway. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to green grass, a road, a rock, water, or a fair open space. There comes a time when they seek to make a fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring, when even this external fire element, as great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So these elements, from a Buddhist point of view, we see the physical world as comprised of different elements which are in balance and which are in harmony and which allow life to continue. And notice the way that the contemplation goes is it's comparing that external water element with the internal water element, the external fire element with the internal fire element. That is to say that what the world is made up of, what the universe is made up of, is the same thing as what we're made up of. We are not different from that. And this is a fundamental principle in early Buddhist meditation, the Ajata Bahidha, the internal and the external. Breaking it down, breaking down that difference. We think that I am in here. We think that in this bounded skin, I have my own distinct existence and my own distinct reality. But that just isn't how the world works. Actually, the same elements, the same processes that are going on here are going on externally, that are going externally, are going on here. So nothing that happens in nature and the environment can possibly happen without affecting us. Nothing that we do inside ourselves can possibly happen without affecting the environment. There comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. It sweeps away villages, towns, cities, districts and countries. And again, we've seen this just a few weeks ago in America, the tornadoes. Comes a time in the last month of the hot season when they seek wind by means of a fan or bellows, or even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch do not stir. When even this external air element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. I mean, it's amazing to consider how vast the Buddha's consciousness was, right? Talking 2,500 years ago, to be able to imagine a world where these things are possible, where the oceans could disappear. Right? I mean, it's just, people don't think like that, do they? Even today, we just have this illusion of permanence. We can't accept, we can't bring into our minds the possibility that actually these things aren't going to work anymore. The seasons aren't going to be what they were. Yeah? We had, I remember, last year staying downstairs when we had the day, it was 47 degrees? Remember that? My God, it was hot. Everyone was just wandering around in this daze going, wow, it's really hot, isn't it? I remember coming up here in the afternoon and it was Raj and one other person and the aircon had broken down, of course. Yeah? This year, Now they're saying we have an 80% chance of an El Nino and likely to be a very strong El Nino as well. Yeah, that's what it's looking to. So we might be looking back to the balmy, placid and pleasant days of mere 47 degrees. Yeah, it's quite likely this year will be the hottest year ever. I mean, when it gets to that temperature, and again, all of these things compounding and adding up and adding up, when it gets to around 46 and 47 degrees, many things start to happen, right? I mean, the electricity grid starts to collapse, right? The train lines start to buckle. Roads start to melt. Bats drop dead out of the trees, right? Fruit bats just drop dead. I mean, they've all had these kind of different communicable diseases and things like that. They will start dropping dead in their thousands. They just fall out of the trees. They can't stand the heat. So what are you going to do? Thousands of dead bats flying around rotting in Sydney's parks. Yeah. Kids playing, dogs playing. Yeah. Then the emergency service isn't to pick them up. Well, how do they do that? The train lines have buckled. Right. The roads are full. Who's going to go and pick them up? These are the things that happen when these systems that we rely on. I remember one year, many years ago, it was about 10 years ago now, and it was when I was first staying in Sydney. I spent the day in Sydney meeting my met my dad, and we spent the afternoon. We had lunch and walked around a bit and stuff. And we noticed that there seemed to be a lot of people gathering around the train stations. And it turns out that there'd been a scare about a gas leak in one of the underground lines. And they basically had shut down the underground. And it was now about 4:35 o'clock. And it was just unbelievable. We went to Central Station. All the trains were just sitting on the lines. Police everywhere, everything cordoned off. Every bus was completely full. The road was completely jam-packed. Nothing was moving. The entire city had just basically shut down because of one gas scare. Yeah? That's how fragile these systems that we rely on really are. Yeah? So, and that's in Sydney, which is, relatively speaking, not too bad. Yeah? A fairly well-developed and fairly together city. Mm. Okay, so let's have a look at another sutta, which also talks about the end of the world. So Buddhism has this very nice apocalyptic tradition. This is from one of my favorite suttas, the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta in Digha Nikaya number 26. And it's a fantastic sutta, which gives a lot of really interesting information and so on, which I can't go into now. But one of the things that this and similar suttas do in an earlier part, which I don't have here, is they talk about what are the conditions for the decay of society and so on and so forth. And one of the things that they point about is human greed. And the fact that human greed causes the deterioration and the collapse of the environment. Okay? The interconnection between our greed, right, and the environment, right, that's what causes those things that we looked at before, the collapse of the elements and so on. Right? And that's specifically been talked about by the Buddha 2,500 years ago. And as the outcome of that, he then talks of, in this particular passage, again, this is just abbreviated, it's just a few passages I wanted to pick out from this quite long sutta. From the not giving, and this is just giving a background, from the not giving of property to the needy, poverty became rife. From the growth of poverty, the taking what was not given became increased. From the increase of theft, the use of weapons increased. From the increased use of weapons, the taking of life increased. And from the taking of life, lying increased. And then people's lifespan decreased and their beauty decreased. And so things keep on going on and getting worse and worse. Monks, there will come a time when the children of these people will have a lifespan of 10 years. The girls will be marriageable at 5 years old. And with them, these flavors will disappear. Ghee, butter, sesame oil, molasses and salt. Among them, kudrusert grain will be the chief food, just as rice and curry are today. When I was reading this passage, I was actually quite struck, and I just did a little bit of research on it now. When I was in Sri Lanka around the New Year time, I had some discussion with Deepika and Radha about this, researched a bit about the impacts of climate change in Sri Lanka. And Sri Lanka is regarded as a place that has a high vulnerability to climate change with a high degree of certainty. The rains will become uncertain, there'll be drought periods and then floods which will wash away the topsoil. all the usual kinds of things which we can expect. But one fun thing which they also said was that Sri Lanka is marginal in terms of the rice growing temperatures. If it gets even a little bit hotter, you won't be able to grow rice. And rice, of course, is the biggest crop in Sri Lanka. If you see pictures of the Sri Lanka's president, Rajapaksa, you see he always wears these kind of white clothes with this kind of brick red scarf. Yeah? And the brick red scarf, so I was told, is symbolic of the kind of the millet, the country millet, like it's like a coarse country grain that's grown in some parts in the south of Sri Lanka. What do they call it again? Kurakan, yeah. And is it a kind of millet? I think it's a kind of millet, isn't it? Yeah. Exactly, there you come. There you go. So Deepika's being very patriotic there. So he kind of wears it as a sort of reminder of his roots. You know, he's still a village man at heart, so he would like us to believe. Anyway, and so in years to come, we will probably be finding that in Sri Lanka they'll increasingly have to grow the millet instead of the rice. And when I was reading this Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta, and basically it's saying exactly the same thing. The kudrusa grain will be the cheap food. I'm wondering, because kudrusa is actually, what is it, kukuran?
Kurakan.
Yeah, it actually sounds quite similar. I wonder whether it's actually the same thing. It certainly sounds similar. I couldn't find any identification in the dictionaries and so on, but it's either the same thing or certainly a very similar situation. So they're basically coarse grain will be eaten rather than rice and curry. And the 10 courses of moral conduct will completely disappear, and the 10 courses of evil will prevail exceedingly. For those of a 10-year lifespan, there will be no word for moral or good, kusala. So how can it be anyone who acts in a moral way? The word good disappears. Among those of a 10-year lifespan, no account will be taken of mother or aunt, of aunts, of mother, sister-in-law, teacher's wife, one's father's wives, and so on. All will be promiscuous in the world, like goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, dogs and jackals. So this is pointing to the collapse of the incest taboo, which is the most kind of basic structural element in any human society. Among them, fierce enmity will prevail for one another, fierce hatred, fierce anger, and thoughts of killing, mother against child and child against mother, father against child and child against father, brother against brother, brother against sister, just as a hunter feels hatred for the beast he stalks. And for those of a 10-year lifespan, there'll come to be a sword interval of 10 days, during which they'll mistake each other for wild beasts. Sharp swords will appear in their hands, and thinking there's a wild beast, they'll take each other's lives with those swords. But there will be some beings who will think, let us not kill or be killed by anyone. Let us make for some grassy thickets or jungle recesses or clumps of trees, for rivers hard to ford or inaccessible mountains, and live on roots and fruits of the forests. And this they will do for 7 days. So this is, I think something, you know, I don't know. We were talking with a group of people some time ago, and they one of the things that came up was talking about indigenous spirituality and how in indigenous spirituality you have a much closer sense of connection with nature, of being part of nature, and of course being a wonderful part of that way of being in the world. But I'm wondering whether a more useful thing to learn from indigenous peoples is not necessarily their spirituality, but hunting and gathering skills, how to get the roots and fruits of the forest. Then at the end of 7 days, they will emerge from their hiding places and rejoice together of one accord, saying, good beings, I see that you are alive. And then the thought will occur to those beings, it is only because we became addicted to evil ways that we suffered this loss of our kindred. So let us now do good. What good things can we do? Let's abstain from the taking of life. That would be good practice. So the first moral principle is harmlessness. And so they abstain from the taking of life, and having undertaken this good thing, they practice it, and through having undertaken such wholesome things, they'll increase in lifespan and beauty, and the children of those whose lifespan was 10 years will live for 20 years. So it's not going to go on forever. It will have a limit. So anyway, this is the Buddhist story of the apocalypse and how it comes about. Again, only in brief, the story goes on to tell how things gradually keep on getting better until in the future Maitreya Buddha appears. So one of the things I think which I struggle with a bit is that you have two aspects in religions, in a profound religion like Buddhism. One aspect is like an ethical aspect, is what do you do? What's a good way to live? And the other aspect is an existential aspect. It's like, how are we to be? How do we know? How are we conscious? And one of the things that we find in spiritual circles is that often people will kind of, I think, confuse those two levels and those two ways of seeing things. And do it in quite what I think is a very unskillful way. And so when something like climate change is presented, a lot of people say, oh, well, everything's impermanent, so we can't do anything about it. Right? And I think that's really trite, and I find it extremely annoying. Right? But now I'm finding I'm saying the same thing. So I don't know. You know, these things I'm struggling with. I mean, obviously, in a sense, it's true, right? We do. It is all impermanent. It is all not self. I mean, we're all going to die anyway, right? So, yeah, in one sense, of course, that's all true. And, you know, but then our choice is, what do we do about that, right? How are we going to live our lives, right? What kind of karma are we going to make, yeah? Are we going to get reborn here? What kind of world are we going to be born into? So these, I think, are things that... And I think it's important not to be glib about this. So just to say, oh, it's impermanent or whatever, or it's been like that before. And, you know, and to me, that's an excuse to not face up to the reality of the suffering. I mean, if these projections are right, and if the statements by, you know, radical left-wing organizations like the World Bank are correct, right? Then we're going to be facing millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of deaths. Okay? Some people have talked of a sustainable population for the Earth of 1 billion. Where does everybody else go? They die, and they die not in a good way. And it will, of course, be the poor and the vulnerable who will suffer these things. Okay? The denialist countries will continue to deny. And we will continue to be short-sighted in the choices that we make. A wonderful article by George Monbiot from The Guardian just came on the last couple of days. Why we couldn't care less about nature and the environment. And basically, yeah, the richer we are, the more we consume, the more self-centered and careless of the lives of others we appear to become. That's the basic psychology. Yeah? The more we get, the more we want. The more we have, the more we think we're entitled to have that. And many years ago, when before one of the completely useless and failed round of climate change negotiations, I think it was George W. Bush said, the American way of life is not up for negotiation. So, see, there's a nice map here, and it's a bit too small to see, but on the colours, the green is very good. So this is, again, from one of these radical left-wing organisations, the Smith School at Oxford. Okay. So, obviously, they've got a kind of socialist agenda they're pushing here. So this is about the different countries' assessment, the overall assessment of different countries in their response to climate change. Again, these figures are all from that blog post I pointed to you before, Think Progress. And this is, I think, a little bit out of date. This is probably 2010 or 2011. So this doesn't even take into account the actions of our current government. This is on the actions of the previous government. So very good is dark green. Okay, so you see a few countries responding quite well to the climate change threats. Mostly poor countries. Good. Yeah, so the green ones are generally good or better. China and India, not too bad. Africa's kind of patchy, poor, and when you get to the yellow and orangey colours, poor and very poor. So Australia, very poor. Very good. Remember, this is before the current government, right? This is under the Labor government this was done. And the US and Canada also very poor. So there, Europe, ooh, a little bit better, yeah. So one of the things this is pointing to, and there was another figure which was on that post by George Monbiot, that there's a figure which shows the amount, basically the amount that you consume to the amount of guilt you have about your consumption. Right? Very interesting, yeah? The countries where people have the most guilt that they're they are contributing to climate change, yeah, is India. Yeah, that's where people feel the most guilt about contributing to climate change, and various other poor countries. Whereas, blissfully, America, Australia, Germany, and so on, we feel very little guilt about what we're doing, which is lovely. Yeah. So again, this complete disconnect between the reality of what our actions are doing. And how we see that, how we feel about those actions. Yeah? And Australia is still going. I mean, it's just unbelievable. We talked to Greg Hunt a few weeks ago, and he was still going on as if he could go to an international forum and somehow tell people to do something about climate change. I mean, it's just unbelievable the delusion of these people. Yeah. Last slide. Any ideas?
Geothermal
is good. Yeah, geothermal is good. There's one of my very good friends before I was a monk, her name's Mary Ella Hatfield, is a filmmaker. She made a documentary called The Future Makers, which came out about a couple of years ago. I'm not sure if you can get it online, but you can try to have a look online, the Future Makers, and it was about different kinds of technologies, and one of the ones she looked at in there was geothermal, and yeah, it seems very promising, and one of the interesting things about geothermal is that there's quite a lot of geothermal potential in the Hunter Valley, so that means that you can do it where all the infrastructure is, where all the workers are, and you can sort of transition from coal to geothermal, Not too bad a way. Yeah, of course no one's doing it, but you could. Yeah. Meanwhile, well, let's start another couple of coal mines and export another few tens of millions of tons of coal to China and India. Yeah. We had an interesting presentation when we were in Canberra about a month or two ago, and this was by two economists, one of them from Oxford, one of them Australian, and one of the things that they agreed was that the reason why there's been such a massive expansion in the coal industry in Australia is, of course, it's not obvious, right? The coal industry continues to expand despite the fact that coal prices are dropping, right? So sort of you'd think that the rational behavior would be to slow down your expansion, kind of wait till the coal prices went up again and then dig it up. But they're saying basically they know that the industry has a limited lifespan. Right? They know that the regulatory environment is going to get tougher as the years go on, and it won't happen this year under this government, but it will happen in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and so they want to basically dig it all up and sell it and burn it before that happens.
That previous slide, I just wonder about the take on that though, because throughout I've been involved with cross-blockade,
and the
friends have been on the dam blockade,
yeah.
And people right now up at the mine blockade.
Yes, in Maules
Creek. Yeah, and throughout New South Wales there is immense opposition, especially in the northwest. There's 500 groups alone in the northwest that are active against coal seam gas fracking.
Right.
From CWA to farmers groups. So that kind of doesn't take into account that there is incredibly growing opposition. There's a blockade
right
now.
Okay, great. Yeah. So look, that's all good. I mean, this is talking historically. What's the actual result, right? So you can have as many protests as you like, but if they still actually build the coal thing or do the fracking, it doesn't actually make any difference in the end. So this is talking about the results. But it is, as I said, it is a couple of years old, right? So things obviously aren't getting better now. but if resistance keeps growing, maybe we can make a difference in the future, which is great. May I say, while we're on that, I did get an email today or yesterday from Thea Omarov, who is the chair of ARC, Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, and she is looking for a Buddhist or some Buddhists to go with her to Maules Creek to the protest up there. And she wanted me to go, but I couldn't because I don't have time. So, anybody's interested? Yeah?
Go up.
Northwest New South Wales, north central, kind of inland from Coffs Harbour, more or less.
It's near
Narrabri. Oh, yeah.
What's
the rainfall there?
Rainfall?
I'm not sure.
Dry, I guess.
It's wet, it's wet up there. So
Well, I think there's a national.
It's just 30 inches, probably.
They're mining in a national park there, or in a park or something. They want to build this big mine, it's a coal mine. So there's a lot of protesters there. Thea got herself arrested a little while ago, which is great. Now, Thea is this kind of, quite conservative housewife in her 60s, something like that. And she's a Catholic. And she came back from Walls Creek and she's saying, all my friends are all Christians and they're all Catholics and so on. And the ferals at Walls Creek are the real Christians. So, if anybody is interested to go up there and lend a presence and give some support to the people there, they're really doing it hard. It's a lot of suffering and a lot of work, but they are putting their lives on the line to help save our planet. So I think it's a fantastic thing. Yeah. So yes, look, people can change things, yeah? There's a lot of people power movements and all of that kind of stuff. So hopefully that can happen. For myself, I just have to say, I think it's uncertain at the moment. I think that might make enough difference, if enough people mobilized quickly enough and made enough change. But, we also have to look at the reality. I mean, the reality is we just voted this government in a few months ago, and that's what the Australian people wanted. It's not as if what they've done is a surprise. And one of the things I think that we have seen in the last 10 years or so is a greater polarisation in a lot of areas, and I think in climate change is one of those. There was a statement Obama made about 6 months ago where he said that the science on climate change is settled, and everybody was saying, that's really good to hear him saying this confident thing, and now we can say the climate is settled. And then somebody said, well, actually, here's a speech from Bill Clinton saying the climate science on climate change is settled in the 90s. Yeah. So if that movement is there, but the disinformation and denialist movement is also there, and the disinformation and denialist movement is funded by the companies which are the most profitable entities that have ever existed on the planet. Yeah. So whatever resources that we can bring to bear, it's nothing compared to what they can do. Okay, other questions? Anyone need a shoulder to cry on?
I'm surprised that nowhere in the world yet has come out the idea of putting a tax on this. Like, we've got this carbon tax, but
right.
We're just like keeping ourselves with it. There should be a tax on everything imported from China because they're doing nothing.
Right.
There should be a tax imported on everything imported from America because they're doing nothing.
Right, more global tech. It actually has been suggested.
They have a trade agreement, I think. That's their problem.
Yeah. No, there actually has been, that has been suggested. I think it was...
we used to, but we don't now.
No, he's talking about something different. He's talking about an international agreement for a tax on carbon.
On carbon.
Yeah. So, I think it was James Hansen, if I'm not... mistaken, or somebody prominent in the climate change movement has actually promoted that idea, and yes, I think it's absolutely correct. It's an international issue, right? And we can say, Australia is building more. See, this is the problem, right? We can build wind farms, and we can put solar cells on the roof, and we can do all that stuff, and it doesn't make any difference. It makes no difference at all as long as you keep digging up the coal and burning it. The only thing that makes a difference is to leave the coal in the ground. You know? And it was that was the point that, you know, when we were talking to the politicians in Canberra, even the best ones stopped at that point. Like, I didn't talk to anyone in the Greens Party, but I did talk to some sympathetic people in the Labour Party. And say Mark Dreyfus has been very progressive and very active on the climate change movement. And when I asked him about that, he just kind of, you know, all of his confidence left him, right? He talked very strongly and very positively and very confidently about that. You know, he's a very impressive man, Mark Dreyfus. And then I said, but, you know, we have to leave the coal in the ground. None of this matters as long as we keep digging the coal up. And then he's like, oh, well, you know, there's clean coal technologies and carbon sequestration. Right. It doesn't actually exist, right? None of those things exist, right? That's like invoking unicorns to solve the problem, right? It's probably easier to genetically engineer a unicorn.
So when they say there are... Because they do say in the media now that there are clean coal technologies at use in China, that's not true.
No. There's nothing. Nothing. There is no clean technology in any industrial scale operating anywhere in the world. They are building two plants in America this year, which are experimental plants, which are testing the technology, right? So we have to see how that goes, right? And yeah, okay, maybe it can help, right? But you know, there are many massive problems with it, right? There's massive problems to collect the carbon dioxide. It takes a lot of energy to collect the carbon dioxide. A lot. I think it's like, was it only like 20% of the actual, reduces the efficiency of the coal plant by 20% or something like that? Right? So 20% of your energy is actually put into collecting the carbon. It might not be the actual figure, don't quote me on that, but it's a huge amount anyway. And it's all untested. Nobody's done it at an industrial scale. And then, of course, you have to retrofit thousands of coal plants around the world and all of those other problems which nobody's actually got any idea of doing. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, compressed air, yeah.
So that's the same as a solar panel on the roof.
Well, again, it depends on where you get your energy from, right? So, yeah, again, that can be great. All of these things can be really good. See, the thing I think is that the technologies are there. Right? I don't think we need any radical breakthrough technologies. I mean, some fusion or something would be great, but with the technologies that we have now, I think we can do it. And the latest IPCC report said that their projection was that if we were going to keep, you know, to make the appropriate adjustments, it would mean a reduction in the projected economic growth. Someone please correct me if I got my figures wrong. I think it was over the next 50 years or something, from an average of like 3.82% to 3.8% or something like that. It was like 2% less economic growth projected, right, to actually save our future. That's the cost, right? And we can't do it. Yeah, we can spend $13 billion on getting a bunch of fighter planes, but for, I don't know, shooting Indonesian fishing boats or something, but we can't spend that much to save our planet. So yeah, I think all of these technologies, humans are very ingenious, and we can apply all those things. We can do it, but we need to have the will to.
I have a question about, so if we have the technologies and we have the science, we have the awareness for a certain amount of humanity. Is it a question of consciousness and ethical connection? For the people who are in power, that obviously that's missing, right? We have this awareness,
right,
but
right.
The connection to the prioritization of saving our planet is not there, that greed is taking over and consumption is. So, what's the conversation about
how a connection could be made if people... If this is a philosophical question.
Right.
I'm trying to articulate it.
Sure, yeah.
But if we're all sitting here in a room in the Buddhist library,
yeah,
with a desire to become as ethical as possible, or at least to raise our
right
awareness, how would we connect to the people who are in power? How would they ever connect?
Mm.
Their ethical part, how would their priorities shift from being greed to being ethically good?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It's a good question. Yeah, one thing which I think is, I'm not actually a cynic when it comes to politics and power and things like that. You know, I don't think that politicians are innately evil, right? I think some of them are, right? But that's just because they're people, right? But I think that the people in politics are just people, and I think actually most people go into politics because they want to serve society in some way. Yeah. And most of the time, they could probably make a lot more money by being in the corporate world, and they probably sacrifice much more lucrative careers by going to politics and working really hard and actually doing a lot of good things which we don't always hear about. So I'm not as cynical as all that. But at the same time, they are part of a system, and they are subject to all of these kinds of pressures. And their ability to make changes are highly constrained. Yeah? I don't think that the impetus to prevent change comes from politics. Yeah? I think the impetus is coming from the corporations. Yeah? And that's where the money is. Yeah? And they're influencing the politics. Who gets voted in and what kind of policies they can have and so on. And one of the things which is very difficult now in Australia and in a lot of other countries, but especially in Australia, is that the waters have been so poisoned. You know? I mean, Tony Abbott was extremely successful in manipulating this issue to get into power in the Liberal Party and then to win the election. That's how he did it. And it's very difficult now to talk about climate change in a rational manner in the political sphere. You know? So, and that's despite the fact that a lot of the people in politics actually really know that there's a problem and want to do something about it, right? A lot of them do, yeah? What to say? When we went to talk to the people again, we spoke to Julia Gillard, and she really understands this as a problem and really wanted to do something about it. And she was saying, well, this carbon price on carbon is just a small first step. It's not a solution. You know, let's get this done and let's look to what we can do next. You know, but you can see even that small first step just gets undermined. So how to get politicians to be more conscious? It's not easy. It's not easy to be, it's not easy for us to be conscious. Right? It's not easy for us to get renewable energy going in our place and to do all the right things. Yeah? And yes, we try to set a good example, try to do what we can. But yeah, it's hard.
Can I just
go
to that? So then really my question wasn't necessarily just politicians, but
sure,
anyone in a position of power.
Okay. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this idea of a shift in consciousness globally,
yeah,
this idea of we're in a new age now, and
yeah,
for example, do you know Arianna Huffington, who founded Huffington Post? She's a woman and a very powerful woman in terms of media,
right,
in media, and she has this idea of the third metric and of mental health and self-care and taking care of oneself.
Yeah.
And so, maybe it isn't just about climate change. Maybe it's about people caring more about themselves, actually caring as opposed to consuming.
Right. Mm.
And do you think that there is any sort of shift going on globally with the ethics of our world?
I think that there is. And I do it, and I'm actually quite positive in those things. I think that the world is actually ethically becoming a better place. And I think that a lot of things are now better than they were in the past. We're less racist than we were in the past. We're still racist, but we're less, not so bad as we were. We're less sexist on the whole. Yeah? We don't discriminate against people with different sexualities so much. Yeah? These kinds of things, I think that there are genuine and real changes, and I think that on the whole we're going in a good direction. Yeah? Even things like violence and war is actually on the decline, although you wouldn't know about it from the news. Even if you look at the shift in our sort of global concerns, I mean, we've been told for the last 20 years to be terrified of terrorists, right? Well, before that we were terrified of the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union was this big empire with all these nukes who were ready to blow the world up, right? And now we're supposed to be equally terrified of what, some guys with a improvised homemade bomb who can blow up a few people, right? Actually, the world is, in many ways, I think, getting better. The last month, I believe it was last month, more people voted in the world than had ever voted in history before. Yeah? So yes, there are many good things. And this is why it's such a crying shame. If it all gets cut off, we can actually get better. The question is, of course, will it get better fast enough to make a difference? And this is my fear. Yeah, I don't know. I hope so. You know, I mean, I think it's something we have to work both from the inside, right, and also externally, right? So I've talked a little bit in this talk tonight about somehow I've done sort of social work of trying to talk to people and change people's minds and things like that. But of course, as a monk, the most important things that I do are the inner work. And so what my for myself and also for people when I'm teaching, the first thing we try to do is help people to find contentment, to find satisfaction, to find happiness within themselves. And the more that we can do that, then of course the more we need to find happiness by consuming and all of those things. And of course, not just in Buddhism, but in any, I think, spiritual or religious tradition, that you can find that. So, I think this is a really powerful thing. I think that the more that we can do this and overcome the consumer madness, the better. And it's something I think that everybody here can do. You can all be an example of being a bit more content, right? Using a bit less. Right? And so, you know, we asked about, you know, how much do we need? I didn't bring it with me. Sometimes I usually bring my monk's bag, a sort of brown bag that we have. And so the rule I have these days is that I fit all my possessions in my monk's bag. Right? So if it doesn't fit, I don't have it. That's it. Yeah. So I've got a nice small laptop so I can sit there and see what's good, okay? All right, so I still manage to have those kind of things, but one day I might be as hardcore as Jason and I'll have much less than that. But right, you have that much, and the crazy thing is, literally all of my physical possessions that I've had in my years on this planet will fit into that bag. And half of the things in that bag I don't really need. Yeah? And you ask, what do you want? People ask me, oh, do you want? Do you want something? Is there anything I can offer? Not really. Yeah.
As an extension of it, it almost seems like climate change is really a symptom. And it's interesting, like you're talking about that sort of more consumer, more self-centered.
Yeah.
Whether, and it's interesting as wealth is going up, you need a baseline poverty for to meet your basic needs, but really things like, say, depression, anxiety, that everything else is going down. Now, I guess the other complexity is you've got countries like India, China, sort of probably historically, consumer, in a sense, they're catching up to the world, and suddenly we've got this drive to consume with it. So it's almost sort of that question of the issue in terms of what's driving that need, that consumption and that trend. And it's easy to talk about the politicians and the corporations, but ultimately nobody bought the corporations go broke tomorrow. And so And it's almost that polarization, almost seems to be counterproductive as well.
Yeah, yeah, and that's that kind of us and them kind of mentality and so on. So yeah, we're all contributing to climate change. Every time you breathe in, you're breathing in oxygen. Every time you breathe out, you're breathing out carbon dioxide. You make it worse every breath that you take. This is another thing I find. You know, people say, "Oh, you know, was this due to climate change or not?" And it's like Greg Hunt's statements about the bushfires. You know, there's no evidence that it had anything to do with climate change. Well, complete rubbish, right? Everything is changed, right? Every breath you take is different now. Okay, every breath you take has more carbon dioxide now, up to 402 parts per million. Yeah. It has less oxygen. It has all kinds of chemicals that didn't exist before. Okay? Every breath you take, every cell in your body is different now because of human activity, human industrial activity. Nothing will ever be the same. And there is no way you can go on the planet from the Antarctic to the bottom of the ocean to the top of the Himalayas. There is not a single place you can go where you'll be free from the results of human activity, right? It's even in space. I mean, space is now a junkyard. They're having to build, Japanese are now building a special rubbish truck for space, right? To go around and collect all the stuff to sort of smash into all the satellites, right? So everything is changing all the time. Everything we will experience with every moment is different, yeah? And we are part of that. It is literally our blood and our flesh and our bones. Yeah? One of the movements which I think has the most promise and which I'd encourage everybody here to look into is the divestment movement. Are you familiar with the idea of divestment? Yeah? Most people are not familiar. Most of you probably wouldn't have been familiar with it fairly recently. Yeah? Anyway, divestment is the idea that you take your money out of something that's causing harm. And in this case, take your money out of fossil fuels. And this movement actually began to get traction in the climate change space about a year ago and has been the fastest growing divestment movement ever in history. Again, this is from these economists we heard when we were in Canberra. And they also said that every divestment movement has been successful. Okay? Doesn't mean that it always achieves everything at once, but it's at least achieved something. One of the things that they explain, which I didn't really understand about this divestment, see, I was always thinking, well, these companies are so rich, you know, if someone takes out a few thousand dollars here and there, what difference is it going to make? But actually, it does make a difference because the effectiveness of divestment doesn't depend on everybody taking all of their money out, okay? It depends on enough people taking the money out to change the marginal profit that company will be expected to get in the future. Okay? So people might think, oh, I'm going to get, you know, 4.2% back on my investment, right? So I'll invest in fossil fuels, but actually that's now dropped to 4.1%. So I should now invest in something else. Yeah? Because I'll get 4.15 from something else. Yeah? So if you change the marginal profitability of something, then that can make a big difference in the investment decisions that people make. And you don't even have to change the actual profitability of the company, you only have to change the expectation or fear of profitability. Okay? So if people think, people are going to be taking their money out of fossil fuels, maybe I need to shift my money somewhere else, that's enough. Yeah? And so this actually has got a lot of traction recently. It's taken off in the religious sphere. The Uniting Church in New South Wales a few weeks ago unanimously decided to divest from fossil fuels, and that was a decision made in consensus in a meeting of 500 people in the Uniting Church. So quite a lot of other religious organizations have done the same thing, and we were very proud a few weeks ago when Thea from ARC, together with some other people in the States, wrote an open letter to Pope Francis urging him to divest from fossil fuels. And that letter actually made it into The Guardian, and even on the front page of The Guardian, so that was a fantastic coverage for that. We haven't heard back from the Pope. but Other people are divesting. Stanford is now divesting. They made an announcement just a few days ago. The students at the ANU, when we were there, were encouraging or urging the ANU to divest. So if you find sort of prominent leading organizations like that, I mean, Stanford is a big deal, right? So if they decide to divest, then a lot of people are going to be paying attention. Yeah? So that's definitely something to be thinking about. The big name in the area is 350.org. So if you're interested in that, just go to the 350.org website and they'll give you, it's like information and so on for you to look in your own personal investments, whether it's just investments or your super fund and these kinds of things, changing the bank to ethical banking and these kinds of things, so that we can move away from supporting those organizations that are making money from the fossil fuel industry. As well as your own personal funds, then if you can, you know, depending on what your situation is, but if you can do that in whatever your workplace or institution that you're involved in, then that also is a fantastic thing. So I think that's one of the things that we can do, which I think is probably going to be the most effective, yeah? One of the most effective things.
How do you find out, like 350.org, I think there's saying
that we should divest from the major banks like ANZ, Commonwealth, because they're all invested in fossil fuels. Right. And I think what they send out is that we should invest in other banks. But how do, like, ordinary people find out if those other banks are ethical? Well, yeah, I mean, the name which keeps coming up in that area is Bendigo Bank, that people recommend as being very ethical in the way they do things. I think if an organization, 350.org has a very good reputation, if they're recommending someone, I'd trust their recommendation. But I guess if you want to do your own independent research or something, then it's up to you to do that. Yeah. So how do you feel after talking about this evening? Do you feel, you know, when I first talked about this in Germany, I was asked a question at this retreat, I was kind of reluctant to talk about it because, you know, you're on retreat. I don't want people to get depressed when they're on retreat. It's kind of nasty. Actually, they were, like, really relieved, you know? They were like, oh, it's just, there's, like, we can be honest. We can actually admit that we have these fears. You know? We have these worries. I think it's perfectly rational to be afraid. Yeah? It's perfectly reasonable to be worried. And we shouldn't try to hide it or try to pretend that it's not there. You know, we don't want to indulge in it. We don't want to, you know, spend all our time there. But to just bring it into awareness and just hold it and say, well, that really is uncertain. Okay, maybe we should finish up around then. Is that a good time to finish?